Hello, friends, and welcome to the show. This episode of HR Oxygen is brought to you by Boss Builders University. We've taken all of our video content and all of our HR seminars and webinars and put them in one spot where you can now access them together. If your conference got canceled or you don't feel like doing it virtual this year, you can still get your HRCI and SHRM credits, many of them being in business acumen. Check out our website at bossbuildersuniversity.com. HR Oxygen as a podcast was designed to just come alongside you, the busy, overworked, overwhelmed, and often underappreciated HR professional. And so we try to give you topics that will give you some skills. We also like from time to time to let you talk with somebody who's extremely inspirational. And our guest today fits that bill. My guest today is Michelle Lem. And Michelle is a super interesting person. She is a veterinarian. She is working with homeless youth, and she is a social worker who is also coming alongside of other veterinarians who are experiencing a lot of stress. Now, I didn't really know what to name today's podcast, so I just put it down as emotional labor. This is some of the work that she is working with right now, and I think you're going to find her story really, really fascinating. She's super interesting, and if you're a dog or a cat lover, you're really going to appreciate this as well. So why don't we quit talking about Michelle? Let's just go ahead and talk to her. You know what to do. Make sure the personal item's under the seat in front of you. Buckle up that seatbelt. It's time for us to take off.
Should the cabin lose pressure, oxygen masks will drop from the overhead area. Please place the mask over your own mouth and nose before assisting others. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the HR Oxygen Podcast, the show focused on the overworked, overwhelmed, and underappreciated HR professional. And now, here is the host of our show, the Boss Builder, Mac Monroe.
Michelle Lem, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mac. It's a real pleasure to be here.
I think we were introduced by Alexa, right?
Yes, we were.
Yeah. So Alexa Beavers has been on the show several times. She's one of our favorite guests. And whenever our favorite guests suggest somebody to talk to, we absolutely want to connect. And it's really strange. I was looking at my notes here. We talked about this podcast back in February.
Yes, pre-COVID.
Pre-COVID. You know, back, and I'm looking at this list of things that you're going to do, and it's all exciting. And I probably talked about all the things we were doing. And in the back of our minds, we knew something was brewing, but it's overseas. It won't affect us. And yet here we are. And today is, what is the date today? It's June the 15th, 2020. And our lives have been pretty much shaken up and twisted around. And so it's interesting that we are going to finally do our talk today. So Michelle, from your accent, I gather you are from South Africa, right?
Do I have an accent?
Yes, you do. Yes. It's just in how you say certain words.
So, out and about?
Out and about. About. Yeah, there you go. It's a dead giveaway. It only sneaks in a little bit. But, so I want to find out, first of all, tell me about yourself. Tell me about your background. I want to know what you do, because when we talked, you have several things going on right now. And I think they're very interesting. And I think some of them are actually very relevant. So Michelle, tell us where you're from and tell us what you do.
Well, Mac, I am here in Ottawa, Canada. So I'm at home, like most people during COVID, with my kids. And my background is actually in veterinary medicine. I'm a veterinarian. That was my first training and practice for a number of years. And then started doing some outreach work with people who are experiencing homelessness and housing vulnerability and helping them with their pets. And that kind of led to a master's in population medicine, where I researched the impacts of pet ownership among street-involved youth. And that really, again, kind of propelled this outreach work a little bit further. We were starting to offer human health services alongside the veterinary care for our clients. And that really led me to want to pursue another degree in social work so that I could understand some of the root causes of the challenges that my clients were facing who were living homeless, and understand, I think, better the structural inequalities that that are experienced and that people bring to their lived experience. So yeah, I wear a few different hats. I'm founder of a charity called Community Veterinary Outreach. I'm a practicing veterinarian. I'm also a practicing social worker in private practice, social entrepreneur. So yeah, there's a number of things that that Alexa and I have kind of connected with over the years, and that's what's led to this connection.
Oh, that's great. It's a very varied background. How did you meet Alexa?
Alexa and I worked together when she was with Boehringer Ingelheim. So Boehringer Ingelheim has a global partnership with another organization called Ashoka. And Ashoka is a global organization that was started in the US that supports social entrepreneurs. And what Ashoka found, well, the founder of Ashoka found, was that the responses and solutions to some of the world's greatest problems are actually coming out of the citizen sector. So they're not necessarily coming from the large corporations or government bodies that actually contribute and create some of these large social issues. The solutions were actually coming out of individuals who are committed and passionate about certain causes and are developing innovations to address these social issues. And so Ashoka's founder was looking for ways to bring connections between the corporate world to support these social entrepreneurs and create a network of social entrepreneurs that could support each other. So Boehringer and Ashoka have a partnership called Making More Health. And Alexa was a real key person within Boehringer Making More Health. And so we got the opportunity to work together, travel to Germany, pitch our project in front of a global jury. And that's how we got connected, and we've stayed good friends ever since because we have so many shared values and interests and goals.
Now, how long ago was it that you did this work?
Oh boy. I would say it's probably 4 or 5 years now.
Okay. Wow. It has been a while then.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Well, you wear several hats. I want to explore one hat at a time. It sounds to me like veterinary medicine came first, right?
Yes.
So tell me what you, when you were the age of your kids now, did you know then that you wanted to be a veterinary?
I did. I knew since I was a little girl, kind of like a lot of little girls. You want to ride horses and be a veterinarian, right? So I did, but I was not a good student. So my teachers, guidance counselors, everyone told me, as well as my parents, that veterinary medicine was likely not in the cards for me because academically I just wasn't strong enough. So I took a circuitous indirect route to veterinary medicine that kind of required a lot of self-reflection and and other things to kind of combat those voices that we all have in our heads that tell us we're not good enough or to tell us we're not capable. So it took me a little bit longer than some to kind of reach that goal.
Well, I've heard, and I don't know if it's true, you could probably tell me, that veterinary medicine is more difficult than human medicine.
It is a very competitive program, and that relates to the very few number of programs that are available, particularly in Canada. So currently there are veterinary schools in Saskatoon, Calgary, Guelph, Ontario, and Prince Edward Island. So there's only 4 schools in all of Canada, and so it makes it a very competitive program for sure. So marks are definitely still probably the primary factor in acceptance, as well as obviously other tangible experiences.
So what subjects did you struggle with the most in high school that led the voices not only in your head but outside of them tell you you weren't going to make it?
Oh, all of them.
Okay, I thought maybe, because I know if it's math and science, you're pretty well screwed, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, I have memories of not knowing how to long divide in grade 7, right? You know, and I don't know if it was a function of my education, a function of probably some undiagnosed learning disability, right? A real lack of, I think, goal. I think once I was told the thing that you want to be, you can't be, I just was pretty lost. I'm like, well, what am I doing? Right. What am I? And I didn't really have something else that I wanted to be. And when I sort of find something that got, kind of got knocked down too. So when you're very, when you're aimless, I think it's hard to find the motivation to persevere, to work hard, to reach a goal. And so I think I just kind of floated through just enough to, you know, finish high school. I finished an undergrad degree, but again, not with very prominent academic marks. And yeah, so it was actually, I was very fortunate. I think it's always these people that come into your lives, right, that you don't recognize at the time, but who become very important figures as mentors, supporters, people that believe in you when you didn't believe in yourself. And so I was very lucky to have encountered a professor named Anthony Clark, who was one of my professors in one of my undergrad courses. And again, in his class, I didn't do particularly well, but he is just one of these human beings who's just one of the most passionate and compassionate people. And just, you know, his values and goals are around supporting people. And you don't have to be anything special for him to want to support you. It's just part of who he is. And so he hired me on as a lab technician in his lab. And I ended up working there for the rest of my undergraduate degree. It paid for my education. And then when I was finished, it helped me get a position in Kenya, where I worked at an international laboratory for research on animal diseases that's called now the International Livestock Research Institute. And it was really that experience, really getting away from kind of the normative culture, the dominant discourses in our lives, right? The inner voices and going somewhere completely different with different people and different environments, different sky, that really kind of gave me the space to think about, well, what is it you really want to do? And are you ready and willing to take those steps to do it? So I had to go back to school. I had to go back and upgrade 2 years, you know, get experience before I could apply to vet school. And that's what I did.
So when you went to vet school, did you find that your academics improved, or was it a slog the whole way through?
So I ended up graduating with distinction from vet school, and I show first-year vet students my academic transcript when I do talks, and my first year at university, I have like a couple Fs, a bunch of Ds, right? Oh, wow. And then it actually at the top, it says, you know, degree conferred, you know, doctor of veterinary medicine with distinction, and it looks like this, what, you know, like, what is that even possible? And, you know, again, to me, it shows kind of what real motivation does, right? Having a very specific goal. I'm not going to say I wasn't terrified. I think I will always probably have this fear of failure thing that I live with. And so I worked my butt off in vet school. Like, I worked really hard because I'd had these experiences where I'd failed courses at the university level. You know, I knew I was capable of failing. but I don't see that now as a bad thing. Right? Failing is normal. Failing is important. I actually think it's important to fail when you're young. You know, to fail when you're older is that much harder, I think, because you don't have that quote unquote resilience, right? To know that you can survive this failure, that you can overcome it. And it doesn't represent your identity or your worth or your value, right? So it was, you know, looking back, I think it was a really positive thing that I had that struggle. And then I wanted it all that more, and it meant all that more. And I wanted to work that much more, to be there and achieve that goal that I set for myself.
Seems to me that veterinary school would be really difficult, because I know, like, where we live in Tennessee, the vets, you know, some days they're working on dogs and cats, and then they go out to the farms for the farm animals. I mean, how do you get through that where you know how to treat pretty much any animal? I mean, that's got to be it. If you're like in human medicine, there's just humans. You're not treating monkeys and things along the way. So do you have to specialize? That sounds like a dumb question, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's not a dumb question at all. Some of the veterinary programs allow you to specialize in the last year or two, where you would focus on companion animals or food animals or horses, for example. And then there are, just like in human medicine, internships and residencies that you can take if you want to further specialize. So in veterinary medicine, there are all the specialties that are in human medicine. So oncology, dermatology, ophthalmology, surgery, internal medicine, all those things are available in veterinary medicine as well. But there's people that go into mixed animal practice, which is primarily food, horses, and companion animals. The folks that really impress me are those that go into zoo medicine. I have a colleague, Doug, who is one of the senior veterinarians at the Calgary Zoo, and I had the great opportunity to spend a day with him walking around the zoo. And people would come up to him with a question about a penguin, or a question about one of the lions, or a question about the gorillas, like vastly, vastly different species. And he just has this like incredible knowledge base around all these different species. So for us, I think working on dogs and cats, that's where I primarily focus. It's less diverse than someone who's doing zoo medicine or wildlife medicine.
Well, still important, because I think most people that, you know, are going to go see you probably have pets. So, that's where you go. So let me ask you a cat question then. I was thinking about this yesterday. I was on the front porch and my cats were in there. Now I've heard, I don't know if it's true, that cats have something like 46 muscles in their ear. Am I off on that?
Ah, I don't know that actually. We do anatomy for sure.
I was going to ask you if you could name all the muscles. I just didn't know if you had to memorize stuff. Obviously not. I guess I better go to vet school then, huh? Because I was watching their ear. Like, it was just twitching on its own, and the cat was asleep, but the ear, there'd be a noise and the ear would move. It was the weirdest thing.
Yeah, they're pretty remarkable.
Yeah. So what is your favorite, dogs or cats?
Oh, I love them both.
Do you?
Yeah. I'm not firmly in the dog or cat camp. So I've had... I just lost my cat, Arthur, about a year ago, and he was the best cat in the world. And if people say, oh, I'm not a cat person, it's because you haven't met the right cat yet.
I have to agree. Yeah. Because people look at me and say, you're not a cat person. Oh, yeah, I'm both. But I think and my wife, she doesn't like the cats, and they know that. So they do things to piss her off. And, I read this thing. It was a meme I saw on Facebook, and it was the dog looking at the human at home, and then the cat. And the dog says, my owner loves me so much that he decided to quit his job and stay home full time to take care of me. And the cat says, I knew my owner was dumb enough to one day lose his job.
See, this is the voice we give cats, right? Promotes that cat stereotype that somehow they think they're better than we are.
Yeah. Well, and who knows? I guess I think we're just a higher order species of animal. There's some other big animal somewhere in some universe that says, those humans think they're so smart,
Yeah, they're so simple.
We can manipulate them any way we want. All right. So you were doing veterinary practice, and you have now achieved that thing that you wanted since you were a little girl. And then did something change? What made you start looking at other things then?
I really wasn't looking for other things. I had started doing this outreach work down at the Ottawa Mission, and it was such a different population of folks that I'd ever worked with before. And, it taught me a lot about the role that animals play in the lives of people who are experiencing homelessness and housing vulnerability and marginalization. And the opportunity came about for me to do a master's in population medicine, researching that area a little bit more. So at that time, there was some research coming out of the US, but none in Canada. And, I was deeply affected, I think, by the stories of the clients that I had around what pets meant to them, how they made such positive impacts in their lives. And yet there was this really dominant, discourse around, oh, if you can't afford a pet, you shouldn't have it. And if you can't take care of yourself, how can you take care of a pet? And having a pet is a privilege, not a right. There's all these things that were being said, right, in society, the stigma that these folks were facing. Even having, slanderous things said to them if they're on the street with their dogs, right? Being told you shouldn't have a dog, or, calling humane law enforcement on them just for having a pet, for example. And so I was really curious about understanding that more. And at the time, I was offered both a behavior residency at Cornell and this master's in population medicine. And it was a bit of a critical time, right, when you make these choices. And Cornell was just, it was my other kind of goal was to do behavior residency, but it was just wasn't doable at the time, given kind of where my family was at to move to Ithaca. So I ended up doing this master's in population medicine. And that really, I think, changed the trajectory of my career. And my supervisor kept saying, oh, this will become your life's work. And I was like, nah, but it did. And it was a really powerful experience because as part of my, my research was interviewing street-involved youth in several different cities in Ontario, and I had the great privilege of speaking with over 200 youth. So these are youth who range from the age of 16 to 24, who were street-involved, living in shelters, living in transitional housing, and half of them had pets and half of them didn't. And I think, you know, at the time, so my kids were about three at the time when I was interviewing these youth. And it was such a profound experience because, you know, I sat down, I'd interview maybe 10 to 12 youth a day. And just these recurrent stories of abuse, trauma, neglect, judgment, unacceptance, not being wanted. So moving through children's aid or childcare systems and into foster homes. It was actually very upsetting and very traumatizing. There were many days when I'd come back and I would just cry my heart out because of the stories that I heard by these kids in our communities that didn't get what they really needed from the adults in their life. And it really taught me you know, how important the basics are, right? Unconditional love without judgment. And that is what these folks get from their pets. And, you know, to say to a youth who has never had an adult love them unconditionally, support them, want them, see their value and their worth, even when maybe they didn't, and then they have a cat or a dog, and that is the first time they experience unconditional love. It's the first time that they are cared for and accepted, no matter what they look like, what they do, how they talk, where they hang out. These pets actually provide them with something that the community, society, adults haven't. And so to say that they can't have pets, it is just was incredibly wrong to me, because to me, it's an indicator of kind of a failed system. We failed to support these kids when they needed us, and now they found it in a pet, and now we're judging that. It just seemed incredibly wrong. So it was a really important transition for me, because as a parent, as someone who works and advocates for people to have pets, you know, I've heard so many of these stories of how these pets have saved their lives, how these pets have motivated them to decrease their drug use and their alcohol use, motivated them to avoid getting arrested. I've had youth say, I'm housed because of my dog, because I don't want him to get sick. I don't want him to, you know, to not have shelter. And so what happens is for many of these youth is by taking care of their pets, they learn to take care of themselves. They start thinking, well, if I'm not around, who's going to take care of him? So I need to take care of myself. And they learn through their pets that they have value, that they have worth. My pet counts on me, you know, and it's incredible. It's incredible that these animals can do something that we as a society have failed to do. So in this work that I do in outreach, it's to support them in these relationships, because we recognize the profound positive impacts that pets play in the lives of people who are isolated and marginalized by other systems.
So is this in Canada that you're doing this, or down here in the US?
So in both, actually. So we operate in 9 communities across Canada, and we just launched in the US under Community Veterinary Outreach USA. It's being led by a young veterinarian named Dr. Lara Plass. And so that's in Kansas City. So that's just started recently. And so they have had a couple events down there, and Alexa has been part of that development as well.
So your work with them, so do you actually do conversations with these young people and their pets? Do you take care of their pets and do exams and things? How does How do you impact that work?
Right. So pre-COVID, so we've had to suspend our activities right now because our events are typically large groups. We have anywhere between, 20 to 30 volunteers, and then we'll see anywhere between 30 to 50 clients in an event. And we offer free preventive vet care. And we also, what's innovative about our work is that we also have human health support available at our clinics. So we call this One Health, where we're supporting both the health and welfare of pets and people. And so clients come in, they're referred through community agencies who work with those who are experiencing homelessness or housing vulnerability. So they can be community health, public health, mental health agencies, community health centers, public outreach nurses, for example. And they come with their pets, and we support the pet's health and provide veterinary care. And then we also have human health practitioners that may include pharmacists, nurse practitioners, dental hygienists, social workers, etc., who are then able to also support the person with whatever is going on in their lives.
What's the average age of the young people that are in sort of this community?
There is no average age. I've met clients as young as 12.
Jeez.
And then there's marginalization, homelessness across all ages and homelessness. So we see this, you can think about it. So we think youth, we think victims of domestic violence, we think seniors, veterans, increasingly families. For example, single mothers represent a high proportion of those living in poverty. So it's really spans all ages. There isn't a dominant age group. So it can affect anyone, right? Homelessness is not a choice. I heard an executive director of a shelter once say, we're all two steps away from being homeless, And so I think that's the thing that I've always connected to is kind of this vulnerability but by luck and by support and by privilege that I was born into, I'm not homeless. Right? Or at risk at this point. But I've met university professors who have become homeless. I've met wealthy business people who, due to a gambling addiction, became homeless, right? So even socioeconomic status did not necessarily protect you. I think the way that we live in this low interest rate state that we're in right now, for example, we're all over borrowed. So it doesn't take a lot to put someone into a vulnerable position where they can't afford their mortgage anymore. So COVID, this is really going to impact homelessness. Not only are we seeing increased rates of domestic violence and family violence, which is going to lead to more homelessness, we're also seeing, an unprecedented job loss rate. So, and economic uncertainty. So again, we're going to start seeing, I think, and not to be all doom and gloom, but the impacts of COVID over the next few years with regards to homelessness.
So where do you go now? So you got the master's then on top of your veterinary degree, and then that was the one from Cornell. And then I thought you had mentioned you did something in social work too, right?
Right. So no, my master's in population medicine was actually at the University of Guelph. So then I go back. I'm doing more outreach work. We're scaling into multiple provinces now, and I'm a huge people person. I enjoy people. I like serving people. Our model of in our outreach organization is servant leadership, which I'm a huge supporter of and try to practice as a management approach. And I'm feeling like I really want to be able to support people in a more tangible way. So because our organization is really focused on that human bond, that relationship supporting both people and pets, I felt a little bit limited in helping the people as a veterinarian. I could help their pets, and we have amazing volunteers, veterinarians and technicians and assistants and students who do such an incredible job. And I was searching for ways in which I would have, you know, the credentials, the training to be able to support the people that we are seeing now, right? So these are the folks that are living with, you know, mental health challenges, substance use, structural inequalities, right? Like daily experiencing stigma, racism, heterosexism, classism, like all those things, right? And I had been in a strict science stream for my whole education. And so I didn't even have the language to be able to connect with them or connect their lived experience to kind of broader systemic and structural barriers. And so I was really lucky that where I live here in Ottawa, Carleton University offers a 2-year master's of social work for those who do not have a bachelor's of social work. And that my outreach experience in working with vulnerable populations was adequate to meet the criteria of having worked in the field for a number of years. So I was really lucky to be able to complete a master's of social work. And that by far has been like one of the most impactful educations that I've had, because again, my education was so limited in terms of science, right? And there's a certain way of thinking and operating and processing information in science that is quite different than social science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. So where do you go from here? Because you don't strike me as the kind of person that says, I finally arrived, I'm just going to sit here for a while. Have you got any ideas of what could be coming down the line next for you?
Yeah. So when I went back to do my social work degree, I'm still deeply, deeply committed to the veterinary field, to the human animal relationship, and really wanting to bring social work values, ethics, approaches to this work. And so the research that I focused on in my master's of social work was looking at, for example, as I mentioned, the link between animal abuse and domestic violence. And so as part of that work, I developed a risk assessment for animals in situations where there's family violence. And I also did my research on looking at the impacts of fee-for-service care on the mental health of female veterinarians. So veterinary medicine is a little bit like dentistry. It's a little bit like some of those other, like chiro physio, where you pay out of pocket for those services. It's not covered. Unless you have, of course, extended healthcare benefits. And it's really challenging because, unlike physio or chiro, veterinarians are often faced with life or death make decisions around the pet. So if someone can't afford physio, for example, it's not necessarily life or death, right? But if someone can't afford to treat a block cat, it is. It is now either euthanasia or having to be able to pay for the treatment. So it's one of those areas that we just aren't really speaking about a lot. We're talking a lot about accessible care right now, which is part of that conversation, but we haven't really looked at how does that impact a person's individual experience in terms of job stress, job strain, burnout, when we have those kinds of those tensions between ability to care, wanting to care, having the capacity to care, and then finances on the other end of it. And so I used an approach that we talked about a little bit around, it's called emotional labor, to look at the work of resolving those emotional tensions or dissonance, as they're described in the emotional labor literature, and techniques that can be implemented or how people deal with that dissonance, and exploring kind of what are some other options. I don't know if that's something you want to go into a little bit more. But
yeah, actually, very much so. I think I had read an article, maybe it was a year ago, about how the suicide rates of veterinarians was skyrocketing. And I asked our vet down here in Erin, Tennessee, and he says, yeah, him and his wife have a practice together. And he says, we've been in practice there long enough that we're beginning to see, when we did like puppy wellness checks, that dog is now 15 years old and we have to make that really hard decision to euthanize her. He says, that's crushing. It's really hard. And so I'm just wondering, you know, if that's a trend that you're noticing too, that it's just wearing people out. Yeah, I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely seeing an increased dialogue around the mental health in the veterinary profession. There's been a number of really kind of high profile veterinarians who have died by suicide that has also elevated the discussion. Some of the research that that has been done has shown that veterinarians, female veterinarians, are 7 times more likely to die by suicide than their aged peers. That compared to other healthcare professionals, veterinarians are twice as likely to die by suicide. The rates of, depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, job stress and job strain and burnout are quite high in our profession as well. And so there's been a number of things that they've looked at, that might contribute to it. Like, the kind of personalities that get accepted into highly competitive fields could be one driver. Another driver people talk about is, this whole work-life balance thing. And for some, that there is more of a struggle to achieve that. Our access to drugs. So we do have access to controlled drugs. And so perhaps that contributes to our ability to at least successfully, I don't want to say that word lightly, but to actually accomplish a death by suicide, is there. And then the system that we work in, some veterinarians work in isolation. So you can have, a fairly siloed professional experience that might not be mitigated by some of the other support. So there's a number of different, and I think it's never one thing, right? It's always going to be a number of different factors. But one of the things that has not been talked about as much is around this idea around money and how that impacts us. And what I was really interested, particularly in female veterinarians, because what we're seeing is that the challenges that we're seeing in mental health are primarily impacting new graduates that are female and who are associates. So associate meaning you're an employee, you're not a partner. So there's this large group of individuals who are at higher risk for job stress, strain, and burnout than other groups. And so that's why I was interested in it. And that females traditionally have been expected to be unpaid caregivers, right? So as mothers, as caregivers for other family members, there is a certain amount of socialization of women and females. There is a social expectation that we are caring and should be caring and not necessarily be paid to care. And so sometimes this really flies in the face of this way that we have veterinary medicine set up, which is you literally need to be paid to care, right?
Yeah.
And so how do you resolve that? And also the dynamic in which you are part of a triad in essence, right? So it's not just you and the client making these, this is you, client, and the pet, right? So the idea that these human factors impact the animal. So a person's ability to afford the care is going to impact this animal who is really, not part of that system. And yet we know that pets are, our family members. We know that the role of pets is almost childlike for so many. So it's a very difficult position to be put in when care is tied to an ability to pay for it. So the emotional labor piece looks at the work that we have to do in our jobs to kind of put on a face, to display a behavior that is expected. So coming back to kind of the experience that you just described around euthanizing, a longtime pet and patient of yours, and you're very attached to this client, and you see them in distress and upset. You see this patient now that you said, you've seen as a puppy. And then what happens is we often have to turn around from that euthanasia and go into a new puppy appointment. So it's not unusual for us to like be crying with clients over the loss of this pet, even though maybe it's time, and then having to turn around and immediately go into a puppy appointment and display a completely different set of behaviors that are inconsistent with how we are feeling on the inside. Or if you have a negative interaction with the client, it's not unusual for clients to get really upset or angry, especially if they can't provide the care. And sometimes anger comes out. It manifests as anger when it's really their fear that they can't help their pet. But you have to put on a face of maintaining calm, composure, professional, right? All those things, even though you're feeling something quite different on the inside. So this is what we talk about as the labor, because you're essentially being paid to put forward and display a certain affect, a certain composure, right? And it's often inconsistent with what you're feeling on the inside. And what the emotional labor research shows is that this dissonance, when we are not aligned with our internal and external experience, is that contributes greatly to job stress and burnout.
So how do you help folks like this? Because is this kind of the, or is, you've got all these things going on, Michelle. I don't know how you managed to do this. So is your work now with veterinarians, is this your primary role? Because I think you still practice too, don't you?
Yes. I so I like to keep my hat in all the rings.
Yeah. Apparently you don't like the sleep either.
So yeah, I do have a social work practice, and I like to support veterinarians in their professional capacities and mental health. I mentor a number of new graduates as well. So, you know, I think it's really around helping people to feel empowered to change a system and to, you know, and while also giving them the tools to better navigate this system that we're in. So the idea of fee-for-service care isn't going to change anytime soon. But, you know, and I'm sure in your audience of HR professionals, right, they experience probably similar types of experiences. It's how can we avoid kind of the negative spiral when we have a negative interaction? How can we as a team come together to support one another in a positive and reflective way while also validating the person's experience and allowing them to express the emotions that they're expressing? So it's a bunch of different things. Coming back to the emotional labor work, you know, when we fake it, which is what most of us tend to do because we don't have the time to really align and reflect, that's called surface acting. And then when we're able to use tools such as like cultivating empathy, deconstructing these situations with the team member, that's called deep acting. And that's really the goal in these situations is to find these tools and skills to be able to realign your internal state with what you're displaying externally. So if you can say, this guy that just yelled at me and said, I'm a money grubbing veterinarian that doesn't care about animals at all. if you can say to yourself, or you could cultivate kind of maybe an alternate explanation for his behavior. Like maybe he really can't afford the treatment and he's just really terrified that he's going to lose his pet. So if you can cultivate empathy for that client, you can say, okay, maybe that's what's going on for him. It's not really about me. It's not personal. It's really probably this fear. Then you can authentically display empathy, right? You can authentically connect. You could offer, you know, saying, look, I imagine that you might be feeling really worried right now. You know, you can, so you can not only de-escalate this person's anger, but and acknowledge their feelings, but also realign with your own internal state. So these are kind of the skills that I'm really interested in cultivating within the profession, because the alternative is kind of just a downward spiral, yeah. Which is not healthy for the veterinarian. It's not healthy for the team. And it's definitely not good for the client.
Well, I guess I really never thought that they would wrestle with those things. But when you said cultivate empathy, it kind of makes sense, because when you think of cultivating, you think of putting in a garden, which is work. So it's not going to come natural to some folks.
No, and it's hard because we're not really provided the time within our day to have those opportunities to reflect. So other things that in the research has been shown to be effective is to give employees a backstage, so a place where they can actually not have to be on and to actually feel what they need to feel. So that's been shown in other healthcare industries to be helpful, where people can feel authentically how they feel before they have to go back on stage or front and display what they're expected to display, right? And in our day, I can tell you right now, because we're catching up from an urgent care only couple months from COVID, this is the busiest time of the year for veterinarians. I can tell you my days, I don't have time to go to the bathroom. I don't have time to grab a drink of water. I don't have time to eat. We are going constantly. And so it really doesn't permit us any time to reflect or even acknowledge what we're feeling. We're just constantly moving to produce, right? To provide service. And that in itself is problematic.
Well, I'm thinking for our audience of HR professionals, they don't treat anybody, animals, humans, but they are required to be on point at all times. And I really love the idea of having that backstage place where you can go and you can process that. Because what I've seen with so many HR professionals is they get to a point where they don't care anymore. And then HR gets the reputation of they're just mean. All they want to do is make new rules. Every time I go, the door's locked. I can never get in. And I think it wears and tears. I see it when I go to the conferences and see them talking about life. It's their chance to be off stage, I guess. And so it sounds like it's a concept that everybody needs to start building in. And it sounds like you're not able to do that now. Where do you see your work? So are you back full time now? Because you said it was urgent care for a while. And now is it normal appointments with masks and things like that?
Yes. So we at this point are still not permitting the clients to come in. So it takes a lot longer. So we do histories over the phone and then we bring the pet in only. We do our exam on the pet and then we call the owner back, you know, so it takes a lot longer. But mm-hmm. That's how we're operating at this point, as we're navigating, like everyone else, new protocols for distancing, et cetera, securing PPE, all those things. So,
well, Michelle, you have so many different things that you can offer us right now. But where can we reach out to you if we have questions? And for the charitable work that you're doing with providing care for homeless youth and their pets, is there a place where a person could donate to that, or are you relying on grants? How does that work?
No, we are very grateful for donations from people who support the work that we do. And it can be made through our website, which is www.vetoutreach, all one word, www.vetoutreach.org. And then I can be reached at michelle.lem@vetoutreach.org. And if you're interested in some of the other stuff that I do around social work, I can be reached at info@michellelem.com.
Excellent. All right. So one more question for you. It's a vet question. And I don't know if it's true, but I'd heard that if a cat was to lose the whiskers on one side of their face, they would walk into walls. Is that true?
I think if they still had sight, they would be okay. I think the whiskers probably play a stronger role when there's a very, very, very low light. But cats have actually incredible ability to operate successfully in very low light conditions. So they may be at a little bit of a disadvantage, but I think that they would be okay.
Okay. All right. Just want to look out for my cats. Well, Michelle, I have thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you this morning and just want to wish you the best of luck as you kind of gear up and start moving forward as hopefully things straighten out with our current COVID situation. But again, if you're listening to this today, please reach out. I know that Michelle would enjoy hearing from you and her charitable work certainly could use your contribution. So Michelle, thank you so much for taking time to be with us this morning.
Thank you, Mac.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the HR Oxygen Podcast. We hope you found something today that will relieve your stress, feed your soul, and pump you up to face another day. At Boss Builders, we want to let you know that we appreciate the hard work you do every day as an HR professional. And as a reminder, always make sure to adjust your own oxygen mask before attempting to help those around you. Be well.